I'm Bert Cohen. Welcome to The Bert Cohen Show. Living in the USA. Welcome to another edition of The Bert Cohen Show, formerly known as Portside. The USA seems to be always involved in one war or another, or maybe even a few at the same time. Could that be happening in Yemen? We heard Secretary of State Hillary Clinton recently say, quote, "The instability in Yemen is a threat to regional stability and even global stability." British Prime Minister Gordon Brown recently said, "Yemen is a regional and global threat." And good old Joe Lieberman, independent from Connecticut, said, "Yemen could be the ground of America's next overseas war if Washington does not take preemptive action to root out al-Qaeda there." Well, what is going on in Yemen? What's the reality? How dangerous is it to America and to the Middle East and perhaps oil supplies in general? Our guest today on the Bert Cohen Show is Con Hallinan, who's been here before. He's a columnist for Foreign Policy in Focus. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Bert.
Well, first off, for most Americans, Yemen, who even knows about Yemen? It just first appeared on the radar screen when the coal was attacked back in 1990.
Actually, it was 2000. I got that wrong in the column. I just typed it wrong. So it was 2000 that the actual attack was.
Oh, that's right. It was just before the 2001 September 11th attack. Right. I remember that was the first big thing. And, of course, this past November at Fort Hood, a Muslim cleric, an army officer linked to a Muslim cleric in Yemen killed 13 random people at the Fort Hood army base. And there was the attempted Christmas Day bombing of a Northwest Airlines flight by a Nigerian, apparently planned in Yemen, apparently in retaliation for the U.S. military support for the Yemen government. Where is Yemen? Tell us about what it is.
Well, it's in the physically. It's at the if you can think of the Arabian Peninsula, which is sort of, if you're looking at the world, it's to the right of the Red Sea. It's the kind of triangle that goes down into the Indian Ocean. So it's opposite of Somalia, Djibouti, etc. And it's always been a very strategic area. The British heavily fortified and used the port of Aden, which is where the USS Cole was attacked, because it controls an important strait that the Bab el Mandab, which it controls access to the Red Sea. And of course, the Red Sea means Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Sudan, Eritrea, and Djibouti. And about 3.5 million barrels of oil come out of the Red Sea every day and go to refineries all over the world. So it's a country, it's a rough country. It's about between 22 and 23 million people. It's the poorest country in the Middle East. It's mountainous in the north. It originally was two countries, North Yemen and the People's Democratic Republic of South Yemen. And in 1990, those two countries merged, never really gelled. That's part of the problem that's going on today. There's a big, powerful secessionist movement in the South and a civil war going on in the North between Sunnis and Shiites on the Saudi Arabian border in the northern mountains. So, you know, it's kind of not on our radar screen, but if people have any kind of institutional memory, or they're just as old as I am, they remember that actually it was a big issue in 1979 when there was an exchange of artillery fire across the border between North Yemen and South Yemen. And the Carter administration said that it was Soviet aggression that was going on. Apparently Soviets didn't even know about it. And sent an aircraft carrier and a bunch of ships there and started funneling money in through the Central Intelligence Agency through Jordan, through the king of Jordan, Hussein, to ramp up tension between North and South Yemen. So it became a battlefield in the Cold War. So you're right. It hardly appears on anybody's radar screen, and then occasionally it just pops up, generally because of something that doesn't really have to hold much to do with Yemen, but has to do with some sort of international issue that's going on. And right now, it's the Cold War on terrorism.
Wow, interesting. The location of oil may not have, I can't imagine that would have anything to do with why it's suddenly important.
Well, you know, we're talking, the Middle East contains 60% of all of the energy resources in the world, both oil and gas. Yemen itself doesn't have much oil, and that's one of the problems is not only is it incredibly poor, I mean, it's got an unemployment rate of over 40%, it does have some oil, but that's going to run out by 2017, and that makes up 70% of the gross domestic product of Yemen. They also are very, very short on water. In the north, it's a possibility that the capital, Sana'a, will run out of water by 2025. So it's a stressed country,
yeah.
You know, as they say, in the midst of these two internal uprisings that are going on.
Well, stress state, I wonder if that necessarily brings up the term failed state. Certainly, it does seem that U.S. officials appear to be interpreting the lack of a powerful central government as evidence of a failed state. And the traditional U.S. approach, as we've seen too many times to count, is to impose central control by force through a large-scale counterinsurgency strategy. Is, as you say, what is now Yemen was North and South Yemen.
Right.
And in 1979, what did Jimmy Carter do then exactly?
Well, it was kind of odd because in retrospect, at the time that it happened, it was very curious because I was a reporter at the time, and I was doing some foreign reporting and writing editorials and things. And when this came up, you know, most of us were greatly puzzled because the idea that the Soviets were making some sort of a major move in the Middle East through Yemen, it just didn't make any sense. And in retrospect, it didn't make any sense. That is, that investigations afterwards showed that the Soviets were completely unaware of this
right.
exchange on the border. But what it did do is, if you recall, in January 1980, which was Jimmy Carter's last State of the Union speech.
Right.
Before the election with Reagan, he enunciated what he called the Carter Doctrine. And the Carter Doctrine essentially said that the United States had the right to use whatever force was necessary to ensure its access to energy resources, which essentially meant that if there was a threat to some place like Saudi Arabia or Iraq or Kuwait or the United Arab Emirates or Qatar or something like that, the United States had the right to use military force to ensure that energy supplies would be continued to be delivered to the United States. So in retrospect, I think that it was a kind of a manufactured event. But what it did do is that it laid the groundwork by putting Yemen on the radar screen and putting the Middle East on the radar screen and the competition with the Soviet Union. What it did, I think, was that it laid the groundwork for the speech that developed the Carter Doctrine, and which is still at the heart of U.S. policy, not simply in the Middle East, but for that matter, worldwide.
So then President Obama appears to be buying into the Carter Doctrine, which seems like a version of the Monroe Doctrine, frankly, that we had hegemony over this hemisphere, and we have a right to interfere. Then there was the Truman Doctrine as well, where any country that he deemed to be threatened by the Soviet Union or some myth of, you know, godless monolithic communism, that we therefore had a role and a responsibility to intervene. So here's President Obama, People Voted for Change. What is his, is he buying into the Carter Doctrine, where if our energy supply is in any way threatened, we have a right and perhaps an obligation to intervene militarily?
Well, he certainly hasn't rejected it. No administration has rejected the Carter Doctrine, and I doubt that you would get them to do so. Certainly, the U.S. current deployments in not simply Iraq, but Afghanistan, which is sort of central to control of Central Asia, these are closely related to energy. You know, is it all about oil? No, as the joke goes, no, some of it's about natural gas. But a large part of it has to do with energy security. And
right.
I think that's the way that people need to think of it. And people say, well, it's about oil, and, you know, is it really about oil and gas? It's about securing not only access to energy resources, but also being able to put the squeeze on the access that our potential competitors might have to energy supplies. And in this case, we're mainly talking about China.
Right. Yeah, I was wondering how China played into it, and there's been sort of it appears to be a ramping up of a struggle between China and India, both of which are, you know, connected to the Indian Ocean, where Yemen is kind of at the gate between Saudi Arabia and those other oil-rich countries, you know, and there's India's right there and China as well. So how do India and China factor into all this stuff with the U.S. and Yemen?
Well, you're very right, Bert. There's this curious thing which is developing. And again, this is mostly off the radar screens for most people. There are these odd incidents on the India-Tibet border, way up in the eastern Himalayas. And it's an area of, you know, it's basically, it's not even a place that goats would go. I mean, it lacks population and oxygen, and so it's not an area that you would consider strategic or anything. But there's been this real increasing tension between India and China. The Indians deployed two divisions of infantry and bought up warplanes a couple of months ago. Chinese have put a lot of troops into Tibet, have built the infrastructure up in Tibet, and bought you know, railroads and roads close to the Tibet border. So there's this kind of tension and a little bit of Cold War going on right there in this, you know, the eastern Himalayas. But what it has to do with is that back in 2005, the Bush administration went to the Indians and they said, look, let's cut a deal here. We will help you. You're an up-and-coming country. We will help you control the Indian Ocean and the South China Sea through controlling the Straits of Malacca, which are the very narrow kind of choke point between the Malay Peninsula and Sumatra, that 80% of Chinese oil and gas supplies have to go through. China is supplied almost entirely by sea. It's only opened up a pipeline recently. And there was a quid pro quo here. And that is, one, that the Indians would take a much more active role in Afghanistan, which they have done, to support the U.S. And the quid pro quo is that during the election, when Obama said that the issue of Kashmir the disputed territory between Pakistan and India was an important area to talk about, and that he wanted it on the table in terms of international negotiations. It's been dropped off. It's no longer part of the deal. And what the Bush administration did was that it signed this agreement called the 123 agreement with India, which allowed India to violate the nuclear non-proliferation agreement and buy uranium on the international market, even though they're not signatories to the treaty, and to essentially build up their nuclear forces, which has now touched off a nuclear arms race in South Asia between Pakistan and India.
Mm-hmm.
So what you've got is that you've got the United States, and apparently the Obama administration seems to be on board with this, that are kind of putting the squeeze on China because they see China as our potential competitor.
Sure.
And one of the ways that we're doing this is through building up India. It's an inordinately dangerous kind of policy to follow. Right now, if people say, you know, what's the most dangerous place in the world? Most people say, well, you know, Afghanistan or maybe Iraq or something. The most dangerous place in the world is Kashmir. And it's an area which there have been three wars fought over. In 1999, during the Kargil border incident, and the Kargil border incident is disputed territory in Kashmir between India and China, the Pakistanis reached the point of taking their nuclear warheads out of storage and putting them on missiles and starting to deploy the missiles. The Clinton administration stepped in and got them to stop doing that, and then eventually a ceasefire was developed. But I think for your older listeners, you might keep in mind that we came far closer to a nuclear war in 1999 in Kargil than we ever did in the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1963.
My goodness. Wow, what a complicated web is woven.
Oh, boy, it is.
My goodness. Bert yeah. Cohen here on The Bert Cohen Show. We're talking to Colin Hallinan, a columnist for Foreign Policy in Focus, and we are focusing on Yemen, what it's all about. You know, suddenly it's on the radar screen, and people, I wonder if, back to the complex scenario you were talking about geographically between India and China and Pakistan, was there something that President Bush did in 2002 that made matters a lot worse there? It sounds like perhaps that's what you were talking about.
Well, yes. And what happened in 2002 was the Bush administration sent one of these drones, a Predator drone,
oh, yes,
in this case, over Yemen, and fired a Hellfire missile at a car that reportedly included a leader of Al-Qaeda. There were five people killed. We don't know who the five people were. We're not even certain, actually, that apparently this guy was killed, the guy that they were aiming for. And they destroyed the car, blew up the car in Yemen. And that, in a certain sense, kind of set the tone, because recently, in December, the Obama administration, according to the French press, it was done with cruise missiles, fired some missiles tried to take out some leaders of Al-Qaeda, and apparently ended up killing somewhere between 49 and 60 civilians in Yemen. So in a sense, what's happened is we've already begun to extend this drone war, the kind of war that we're fighting in Pakistan now,
right,
where
we've
got these, there have been more than a dozen drone strikes just since the Obama administration came in. And these are sort of extraterritorial. In other words, they fly over someone else's border, and they launch these missiles and assassinate people.
Right.
They're not, by the way, very, very efficient. The U.S. assassinated one of the leaders of one of the Taliban in Pakistan, Massoud, and leader of the Massoud Taliban. But by the time we got to him, it took 14 Predator strikes to do that.
Oh, my.
And we killed more than 300 people before we got our target, before we killed him, before we got our target. You know, I think that there's a lot of hype that gets in the things about these precision strikes and this kind of thing. You know, these precision strikes are carried out with Hellfire missiles, which are very explosive, and 500-pound bombs. And, you know, they're not the kind of surgery that you want someone using for taking out your appendix or something. So we end up killing a lot of civilians. And, of course, those civilians, and this is particularly true in the Middle East and particularly true in Yemen and Afghanistan, are connected to extended families, connected to clans, connected to tribes and confederations of tribes, etc. And we have then, by doing that, we have created this, you know, this sort of network of anger out there that comes back and bites us.
It may be, I suppose, a better weapon, the Predator drone, but it's really bad for public relations. You know.
Well, you know, I think one of the things that's kind of, there's a philosophical, I don't know, like ethical question. I realize it's partly talking about ethics and war is a difficult subject, but, you know, the idea behind war is that one of the reasons why you try to avoid it is because it gets your people killed.
Yeah.
You know, you bring your young people home in aluminum boxes, and so therefore you try to avoid it if it's possible. But, you know, this is a kind of a bloodless war for us, for anybody else.
Right.
These drones are sent up. A lot of them are controlled in southern Nevada, Neal's Air Force Base. You know, someone sits there in front of a little TV screen. It's like a video game. They bounce the signal off of a satellite, so it's real time. What you're seeing on the screen, that's what's happening exactly at that moment. And somebody makes the decision to push a button and blow up a car or blow up a group of people or take out a house in a village or, you know, or whatever. And no one gets hurt in southern Nevada, just people in Yemen and people in Afghanistan or people in Pakistan, you know, et cetera. You know, the question is, if you can fight a war in which you don't bleed, are you more likely then to fight those kinds of wars? Because they're not expensive to you. I think it's an illusion, because I think what happens is that they end up blowing back at you, and people will get their revenge, only the way they'll do it is they won't take on your military, they'll kill your civilians. I mean, that's what 9/11 was about.
Yeah, absolutely. And the people there, as you say, you know, they have family members, and it's really... it's very different from the United States in that, it's largely a Muslim country, which, you know, maybe split into Shia and Sunni, as we've seen before. But people feel a sense of community and are connected. And there are different approaches there, that there's tribal autonomy and people, you know, there's the warlords, as they say, the people who are really in control. And it's not really a central government. And I wonder how all this plays, the fact that is the shape of Yemen right now, that there is a central government, but there's also a lot of the countryside, I'm getting the picture, is not really part...
In many ways, Bert, it's similar to Afghanistan. The central government is only really a central government in name. The way that Yemen and Afghanistan also has always worked is that whatever the central government is, you know, either in Sana'a for Yemen or Kabul in Afghanistan, is that the way you rule is indirectly. You rule through the tribal confederations that you know, control different parts of Afghanistan and Yemen, and you negotiate through the tribes, and it's all kind of indirect. And, you know, that's the way those countries have been, and it's also the way they're really set up. So to attempt a kind of a strong central government flies in the face of really thousands of years, for that matter, of the way that these countries have been governed. And it, you know, it sort of reflects the idea that, you know, the way that we run things here with a strong executive and a powerful central government, that, you know, that's the way... things work. It's
nonsense.
Doesn't. And, you know, even the thing about blood feuds, you know, people say, sure. Oh, okay, blood feuds, you know, these people are so primitive. They're really not. I mean, it's actually a very logical way to run things. If you do not have a national court system or a national system of laws, in which everybody is sort of bought into, then blood feuds are a way of saying, look, don't kill someone in this next village or in this next tribe, because if you do, you're going to set off a feud. And so, actually, it's a way of keeping peace. It isn't a way of encouraging war or encouraging bloodshed. It's a sort of a rule that says, try and resolve these questions without resorting to violence, because if you do resort to violence, then it's going to get out of hand, and nobody wants that. And so that's how these things work. That's why when you kill 300 people in the process of trying to get this Taliban leader in Pakistan, you have killed 300 people who have a vast network of tribes and clans and families, and those people want a comeuppance. You know, they think that the balance needs to be reestablished, and so they'll join the Taliban or Al-Qaeda or whatever in order to do that. So, you know, the best recruiting sergeant we have for terrorism are these drone strikes.
We are talking with Con Hallinan, columnist for Foreign Policy in Focus, about Yemen. Now, is Yemen, has it become a breeding ground for Al-Qaeda? And if so, perhaps you can tell us how that happened and how it is happening.
Well, it's hard to say, you know, because is Al-Qaeda in Yemen? Yes. Most of the figures say that they have between 200 and 300 members of Al-Qaeda in Yemen. Is Al-Qaeda liable to make a lot of inroads in Yemen? Not really.
Why is that?
South Yemen is largely secular. This was originally called itself a socialist government, aligned with the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc in the 1970s and 1980s before the merger in 1990. I don't think there's a whole lot of headway that Al-Qaeda could make in Yemen. They're not going to make any headway with the Shiites, and Shiites make up about 47% of the population of Yemen, and Al-Qaeda is a Sunni organization, and it's a very fundamentalist Sunni organization. It's closely associated with the kind of Sunniism that's practiced in Saudi Arabia called Wahhabism. So they consider, like, this is an actual quote, they consider Shiism, quote, a bone in Islam's throat. So here you have almost half the population that they can't, that they don't have any alliances with. Most of the population in the south is secular, and so what's their base? I mean, they can they can make press releases. They can say we trained this guy, this Nigerian guy who tried to blow up the airplane. Although we don't really know if they did. We don't know whether they're just taking credit for it. So, you know, is Al-Qaeda a regional or worldwide threat in Yemen? That's just absurd. I mean, it's absolutely absurd. I mean, we have created, in part, a threat in Somalia, because what we did was that we helped the Ethiopians invade and overthrow a moderate Islamic government, and now what we're stuck with is a bunch of very, very conservative Islamicists who are now on the ascendancy in Somalia. So, you know, our intervention in Somalia has made things worse. If we intervene in Yemen, it's going to make things worse as well. I mean, there's just a one-to-one relationship. Every time we go in and do something, conditions get worse. And it's true in Iraq, and it's true in Afghanistan.
Does seem to be a broken record. It happens again
it
and again,
is.
And yet we never seem to learn from it. But back in the 1980s, the U.S. was clandestinely supporting the anti-Soviet resistance in Afghanistan. I believe they were called the Mujahideen back then. Did not a lot of Yemenis go to Afghanistan?
A lot of them. And in fact, during the I say the countries merged in 1990, and then they had a war, a civil war, between the North and the South.
Right.
In 1994, that North won that war because the U.S. and the Saudi Arabians poured in lots of aid and lots of money to North Yemen, and large numbers of Yemeni mujahideen came back from Afghanistan and were used as shock troops in the civil war against the South. So that's another kind of wrinkle in this whole scenario. You know, that particular war, that is the war against the Soviets,
right,
has created, you know, this problem that we now have all over the Middle East. I mean, it's sort of interesting. Osama bin Laden released a short tape to Al Jazeera, I guess 2 days ago, in which he sort of hailed the Nigerian attack, the guy who tried to, you know, the underpants bomber, although he didn't take credit for it. Now, what's interesting is, of course, that Osama bin Laden is a Yemeni who grew up in Saudi Arabia, and it was him working for the Haqqani group in Afghanistan. He was Haqqani's leading engineer. Haqqani was the major recipient of U.S. aid and Pakistani aid in the fight against the Soviets. So we not only funded Osama bin Laden, but now we consider Haqqani to be a primary person that we want to get rid of, and we're trying to get the Pakistanis to attack the Haqqani group, because the Haqqani group is fighting the Americans in Afghanistan. So when you say this is complex,
wow,
try chess in three dimensions on acid. the only thing I can think of, you know. I keep thinking of the Americans as, we play checkers, you know. Right. These people in Central Asia and in the Middle East, they play a much more complex game than we play.
And yet, there's a lot at stake for the U.S. It's becoming more of an issue, and it does seem like the U.S. seems to be kind of saber-rattling with regard to Yemen being more involved there.
Well, I do think what they're going to do, I don't think they can send troops. They don't have troops, so they can't send troops in, but they are going to send special forces in.
Well, I understand. I mean, Joe Lieberman says that Green Berets and U.S. special forces are already there.
Yeah, they're already there, and they're training. And I think what they're also doing is that they're going to extend the drone war. So we can expect an increase in drone attacks in Yemen. And the problem is here we are once again supporting the president of Yemen, Ali Abdullah Saleh, he's a despot. His family runs the government. He has lots of political prisoners. They've been responding to these demonstrations in the South for autonomy by, you know, opening fire on crowds and using tear gas and clubs. And I mean, he's a despot. So once again, what's happening is, in terms of the Middle East, we're intervening to support a local despot. And, you know, people forget that when Osama bin Laden talked about 9/11, talked about organizing 9/11, the primary purpose that Osama bin Laden had for 9/11 was to provoke the United States into invading Afghanistan. He was quite explicit about it. He fell out with the Saudi government during the first Gulf War, and because the Saudis allowed the United States to station troops in Saudi Arabia. And he thought that was a violation of Islam. So he broke with the Saudi government over in the first Gulf War, 1991. He then tried to create a situation where he would provoke the United States into invading Afghanistan or another Muslim country, and that would get people in the Middle East to unite against the Americans and throw the Westerners out of the Middle East. And that was the scenario for 9/11 and for what Al-Qaeda is trying to do. Well, every time they have waved that flag, Bert, the bull is charged.
It works.
I mean, we invaded Afghanistan. We invaded Iraq. Now we're intervening in Yemen. We've intervened in Somalia. For most Muslims of the world, what they see is these Christian armies
right.
are invading their territory like they did during the Crusades.
Crusades, yeah.
And people remember the Crusades in
sure.
the Middle East.
Yep.
And we have played into that scenario each and every time.
Doesn't it seem that likely that if the government that we support in Yemen casts a very wide net and becomes even more repressive, aren't we risking more tribal rebellion, other civil unrest that might be seen by a lot of people as repression at the behest of the U.S. Either way, it seems likely to increase support for extremist elements. And there must be others beside Al-Qaeda there, because, as you say, Al-Qaeda in Yemen is only perhaps a couple of hundred people. But isn't this obviously going to stir up trouble that doesn't help the United States?
Well, I think there's a very good model for exactly what the result will be, and Somalia is the model. First of all, Yemen and Somalia are they're not only physically close
right.
to one another, but they also are culturally close to one another. There are, I think at last count, something like 1.2 million Somali refugees in Yemen. Considering that there are 22 or 23 million people in Yemen, that's a significant section of the population. And what happened there was that the United States was supporting a government that was dominated by these warlords in Somalia. And the CIA was backing these warlords. And so there, an organization called the Islamic Courts started up in southern Somalia. And it was a moderate Islamicist group. It was not Al-Qaeda, it was not fundamentalist, it wasn't Wahhabism or anything like that. It was sort of standard Somali Islamicism, which is closely associated with Sufism. It's a moderate form of Islam. And they were quite successful. They spread out of southern Somalia, and they went to overthrow this government of the warlords. And the U.S. backed the warlords. Now, it failed. The warlords didn't have any support because they were warlords. And the Islamicists took over, at which point the United States sponsored an Ethiopian invasion to put a U.S.-sponsored government into power. Now, Somalia, the resistance in Somalia, is dominated by an extremely conservative and reactionary form of Islam. So, I mean, I think that here you have a kind of a precise mirror or crystal ball of what would happen if we intervene in any kind of major way to support the Saleh government in northern Yemen, which doesn't have a lot of support outside of the capital. We're going to get ourselves into a situation where, once again, the people that are going to rise to the top of this are the most extreme elements
sure.
in the community.
And there was that civil war in 1994, and, like civil wars everywhere, they never really end.
No, they haven't ended in the United States.
Exactly, no. That's another subject. But the Southerners are still resentful of the North. The grievances have grown in the South. There's economic disparities, as I understand it, between the North and the South in Yemen. There's a lot of economic problems there. And I wonder if more U.S. intervention could stir up the civil war again, and if that's quite possible.
I think it's headed in that direction, Bert. Most of the oil, the remaining oil, mm-hmm. most of the oil is in the South.
Uh-huh.
And what the South is maintaining is that the North has basically takes all of the oil revenues and keeps them in the North, discriminates against Southerners. I mean, because remember, this was two countries. It's not like, you know, it's not like you have, it's not even for that matter, like our Civil War, where you had people who were, you know, Southerners, you know, people who were Northerners, you know, but basically, in a lot of ways, there were similarities of culture, same language, pretty much the same religion, that kind of thing. This is much more complex than that, and these countries were separate countries for a long, long time. The fact that the one country is brand new, it isn't something that was traditional, and so naturally what you have is you have two very, very different societies living very uncomfortably with one another. And what we're doing is that we're supporting one of them, and we're supporting one that is currently at war with its own Shiites in the North, because that's where the Houthis are located, is in the northern mountains there. They've created more, according to aid agencies, they've created more than 200,000 refugees as a result of the war against the Shiite in the North. And we're coming in and we're supporting this government. So I don't, any way you look at that scenario, it's likely to go bad. And once again, you know, we're going to be outside interveners who are coming in to support this guy who's oppressing a secessionist movement in the South, carrying on a civil war in the North, and discriminating against Southerners. I don't see there's any way that scenario doesn't end up with us with a lot of egg on our face. Not to mention the fact that if we stimulate a civil war between North and South Yemen, this is going to be a pretty bloody business.
I'd say so. Now, who in the United States is pushing for us to be more involved in Yemen? Is it, you know, the Joe Liebermans and I don't know about Hillary Clinton? Who's pushing for us to send more military aid there and to get more involved?
This is a very interesting question, Bert. I wish I had a clear answer. Yeah. That is, I wish I was a fly on the wall on lots of meetings, different meetings in Washington, because there does seem to be a kind of a division in the administration. The people who tend right now to be the most aggressive are Robert Gates, the Secretary
Defense Secretary.
Defense Secretary, right. And Hillary Clinton, and they are the most aggressive in terms of Yemen. In terms of Afghanistan, Gates recently made an amazing kind of statement where he basically told the Pakistanis, you know, if there's some sort of terrorist attack from Pakistan on India, you know, the Indians are going to come get you, and we're not going to say anything. And that, you know, that's the way it is. That's as I say, this is like playing with matches in a gasoline-soaked room. It's the same group of people who reversed the policy of the Obama administration on Honduras and eventually ended up recognizing the coup and now are building up these military forces in Colombia, which we now know are no longer just limited to Colombia. We now know from the Senate hearings last summer that, in fact, the military forces in Colombia, U.S. military forces in Colombia, have continent-wide authority, has reactivated the Latin American Fifth Fleet, which is very upset, very much upset the Brazilians because they have these offshore oil fields, and they're very concerned about what that Fifth Fleet is doing, and they're busy buying submarines on the international market. I mean, this is crazy stuff. And it seems to me that there's a kind of a wing of the Democratic Party that was closely associated with the Democratic Leadership Council, yes, which, of course, the Clintons founded.
Yes.
And it's, you know, it has a very aggressive foreign policy. It's more than willing to use military force, sort of at the drop of a hat.
Yeah.
And I think that is the group of people that are driving foreign policy at this point. I mean, look at the kerfuffle over the Google thing and the way that that Hillary Clinton has portrayed it. If you go back, 50 years, okay, and you substitute the word China for Soviet Union or Russia, okay, the speech that she gave, could have come straight out of the Cold War.
Yeah. It's
so I don't know exactly what's going on. There does seem to be a section of the Obama administration, and they apparently seem to be driving foreign policy at this point.
And
that
it does seem that
going
there's...
back to the kind of Cold War liberalism that led to Vietnam.
Yep. It seems like people like the simplistic, us against them. It's very, it's marketable, I suppose, for the domestic market, but it doesn't work well in those other countries. Like, for example, Honduras. Okay, we have, there's an illegitimate government in there that the U.S. recognizes. Well, isn't that neat? It's all in a box and it's taken care of, except the people also throughout Central and South America know about it, and it doesn't help the U.S. in the long term. And certainly what you said about Osama bin Laden, the reason he gave for 9/11 was to draw the U.S. into other wars and making war on the Islamic world in general. Could Yemen be another situation where the U.S. is walking into a trap? Could this be another quagmire?
Well, I think that's what Al Qaeda's got on their mind.
Sure.
I mean, they keep waving that flag, and the American bull keeps charging. I think that we are headed that way, and I'm concerned about it. I'm very concerned about the kind of militarization which is happening in Africa in general. With the fact that we now have a separate military force called AFRICOM. And we've kind of militarized our relations with Africa, and Africa has areas of great instability. There's going to be a referendum in Sudan coming up that probably will result in southern Sudan breaking away from northern Sudan. That may result in a civil war. The oil is in the south. The military power is in the north. What's this going to mean? Where is the U.S. going to come down on this? We have tended to support the people in the South. Are we going to get involved in a Sudanese civil war? I very much hope we don't have a Sudanese civil war. It's an awful place to have a civil war. Kind of one going on now anyhow, between the East and the West. But, there are a lot of scenarios out there, Bert, that just look really bad. And I don't see us taking, I don't see some new thinking going on. That's what I don't see.
And I think that's one thing a lot of people voted for Obama was for new thinking, something different. Get out of the old Cold War mentality, us big guys against those big guys. Here we have Yemen, which is a very, very complex situation within the context of other complex situations. And it seems clear that Yemen's problems really can't be solved through military action. What could work if you were suddenly in charge of American policy in that region? What could the U.S. do to tamp down support for Al Qaeda? We don't want those guys blowing up airplanes. We don't want them attacking our people. What can we do that would work?
Well, again, we helped create the current situation in Yemen. Back in 1991, in the first Gulf War, Yemen refused to vote to support the UN resolution to throw Hussein out of Kuwait.
Yeah.
So they essentially voted against the war in the first Gulf War. As a result of that, the United States cut $70 million in aid to Yemen, which was a significant cut in aid for Yemen because it's not a big country and it's very poor. And then went along with the fact that the Saudis, who were also very miffed at what Yemen did, fired and expelled 850,000 Yemeni workers that were working in Saudi Arabia, mainly in the oil fields, etc. Those people returned home. Yemen lost their income. There's this huge pool now of unemployed. There was very little aid from the United States going into Yemen. So we helped kind of create this economic crisis in Yemen. Our solution to it at this point is to send them a lot of aid, but it's counterinsurgency aid. It's military aid. It's aid, you know, to fight Al-Qaeda. I think the way to do this, I mean, if the United States wants to be smart here, instead of using smart bombs, we should use smart aid. And that is, if you create conditions in which people have work, they have decent housing and supplies of water, health care, transportation, etc. You know, Al-Qaeda doesn't make a whole lot of leeway. Doesn't really have something that's terribly attractive. I mean, their basic thing that they attract people on is that you have a crisis, you know, an economic crisis, a political crisis, and then they come along and they say, look, Islam is the solution. Right. And the thing about Al-Qaeda is that they're not corrupt. So we don't like the Islamic fundamentalism, but, you know, they don't take people's money, they don't rip off their taxes, they don't, you know, they're honest, and that goes for them. And people don't particularly like the ideology, but, you know, in the midst of chaos and crisis, right, and all that kind of stuff, they're an answer. Well, the solution then is to relieve the crisis that gives them the ground that they can germinate extremism on. But that isn't what we're doing. Well, we're making it worse. We're killing civilians with missile strikes. Gee, that's a good idea.
Yeah, there's that, I think it's a bumper sticker, something about we're creating more terrorists, creating them faster than we can kill them.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we'll never, I mean, you can't have a military solution to terrorism. I mean, I'm working on a column on this. Terrorism is a tactic.
Right.
And it's a tactic which is always indicative of unevenness, of, you know, asymmetrical warfare. Look, that's what the United States practiced against the British. I mean, they thought we were horrible people. They thought we were a bunch of cowards. They thought you should wear bright red uniforms and stand in long straight lines out in the open. We thought that was a very peachy idea. We'd hide behind walls and hide behind trees and shoot them.
Right.
And the British were outraged.
And we won.
You know, this was how dare they? You know, these barbarians.
Right.
Well, you know, no group of people can nobody in the world can face the U.S. military on a stand-up fight.
Sure.
So they do what they do in Afghanistan. They've done for thousands of years. Ambush, you know, disperse when the enemy is strong, concentrate when the enemy is weak. You know, it's a classic guerrilla warfare, asymmetrical warfare kind of thing. You can't defeat that using military force. You've got to defeat it politically.
Right. Give people...
We're a little short on that area.
Yeah, you know, we could be a lot better. People have certainly... There's no lack of people writing about what we could do to help in Afghanistan, places like that. If we get people on our side, win their hearts and minds, then that works.
Yeah.
I don't know.
There's no question. I don't think, you know, the idea that somehow people don't like Americans, I just don't think that's true. I think what it is that their view of Americans is that when they see Americans, they see Americans talking about democracy, and then at the same time supporting, you know, dictators like the president of Yemen or Karzai, you know, who was hardly could call that an election,
right,
you know, or the monarchy in Saudi Arabia, etc. So when they hear us talk about democracy and freedom and all that kind of stuff, they just roll their eyes. You know, yeah, sure, unless it's in your interest not to support that.
Right.
Well, you know, if we want to start to make an impression on people, then we have to get serious about the relationship between what we actually do in the world and our rhetoric. And until we do that, you know, people are not going to pay any attention to us.
And if we could learn from what we're doing in Haiti, presumably helping people,
yeah,
providing, you know, reliable support like we did after the Second World War with the Marshall Plan, it might just work. We keep, you know, what's that definition of insanity? Doing the same thing over and over again and
expecting different results. Well, I mean, this is, you know, as you said it yourself, another quagmire. I mean, here, if you take a look at Yemen, okay, let's go back to the invasion of Afghanistan in 2002. Let's go back to the invasion of Iraq in 2003. Let's go back to, you know, Black Hawk Down in Somalia and everything like that. Oh, let's do it again in Yemen. No, wait a minute. What, you know, you really got to decide. You have to shift our meds. Yeah. You know, we need different meds here.
Con Hellinan, I'm sure we'll be talking to you again. Columnist for Foreign Policy in Focus. That's www.fpif.org. Is it or .com? I forget.
It's .org.
FPIF.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Bert.
On the Bert Cohen Show. And if you want to get in touch with us, we'd love to hear your comments or suggestions. Bert@BertCohen.com. That's BURT@BertCohen.com. Thanks for being with us today on the Bert Cohen Show.
Kim and John are because you had no place to go. There ain't nobody higher right here since I'm jousing down to Mexico. I reckon that learning self-trade made me see the world. Moved to the city someday. Somebody somewhere had another plan. Now he's got a rifle in his hand, rolling in a bag, then wondering how he got this far. Just another poor boy off to fight a rich man's war. Tattooed on his arm, red, white, and blue to the bone, with land in Kandahar. I left behind a pretty young wife and a baby girl. A stack of overdue bills and went off to save the world. It's been a year now and he's still there, chasing ghosts in thin dry air. Meanwhile back at home, the finance company took his car. He's just another poor boy off to fight a rich man's war. Another poor boy out to fight a rich man's war.